Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, January 24th, 2022. Pentagon puts about 8,500 U.S. troops currently stationed in the U.S. on heightened alert for potential deployment to Europe at the direction of President Joe Biden. This with the rising concerns about a possible Russian military invasion of Ukraine. While NATO moves ahead now, sending more forces to Eastern Europe, as Russia accuses the West of inciting hysteria. We'll have all the latest in just a moment. New York City Mayor Eric Adams presenting a plan to combat gun violence. This after last week's shooting death of a New York City police officer who was responding to a domestic violent incident. Mayor Adams' plan includes increasing officers on the streets, curbing the flow of guns into the city, and encouraging prosecutors to move forward earlier with gun charges. On COVID-19, Chief White House Science Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci predicting Omicron variant cases will reach their peak and start to decline across the U.S. in the coming weeks. And prominent anti-vaccine advocate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. criticized for comparing U.S. COVID policy to Nazi Germany. He spoke at a weekend anti-vaccine mandate rally in Washington, D.C. Associated Press in Brussels, Belgium, where NATO has its headquarters, reporting tensions soared Monday between Russia and the West over concerns that Moscow is planning to invade Ukraine, with NATO outlining potential troop and ship deployments, Britain saying it would withdraw some diplomats from Kyiv, and Ireland announcing upcoming Russian war games off its coast as unwelcome. Pentagon leaders have proposed a range of options for President Joe Biden to reinforce the U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe and the Baltics as a demonstration of American commitment, according to two officials speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss internal planning. That was early reporting Monday from the Associated Press. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, during her daily briefing, taking a question about what the president has decided or not decided.
Has President Biden made a final decision about deploying more troops to Eastern Europe?
Well, let me give you a brief update, and I know that my colleague John Kirby is going to be briefing shortly in about 45 minutes or so at the Defense Department. We have been consulting with allies in deployments and refining plans for all scenarios. We've always said we would reinforce our allies on the eastern flank, and those conversations and discussions have certainly been part of what our national security officials have been discussing with their counterparts now for several weeks. In fact, we've never ruled out the option of providing additional assistance in advance of an invasion. Those discussions have been ongoing with our partners and Eastern Flank countries. And again, I would expect that my colleague John Kirby would have more of an update on where the process is at this point in time.
So John Kirby will make an announcement about whether or not he's made a decision.
No, I think he will provide an update on where things stand on those discussions. Okay.
That's the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki in the White House briefing room with reporters. President Joe Biden returning to Washington from Camp David in Maryland today and in the afternoon meeting by video conference with European leaders to discuss Russia and Ukraine. Jen Psaki saying that the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby would have more details. Kirby held his own news conference at the Pentagon Monday afternoon.
The United States is deeply concerned about the current situation in Europe. We remain keenly focused on Russia's unusual military activities near the Ukrainian border, including in Belarus, and consulting extensively with our transatlantic allies and partners. The Department continues to support diplomatic efforts to de-escalate the situation. Now, as the president has said, even as we continue to prioritize diplomacy and dialogue, we must also increase readiness. In support of its obligations to the security and defense of NATO and the security of its citizens abroad, at the direction of the president and following recommendations made by Secretary Austin, the United States has taken steps to heighten the readiness of its forces at home and abroad so that they are prepared to respond to a range of contingencies, including support to the NATO Response Force if it is activated. As you have heard me describe many times, our commitment to the security of NATO allies and our Article 5 commitment are ironclad. As the president has also made clear, the United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us, our allies, our partners. As part of that commitment, the Department of Defense maintains significant combat-capable forces forward in Europe to deter aggression and enhance the alliance's ability to defend allies and defeat aggression if necessary. The United States also has a commitment to provide forces to the NATO Response Force, or otherwise known as the NRF, in the event that NATO should activate that construct. And as you may know, the NRF is a multinational force made up of land, air, maritime, and special operations forces, all components that the alliance can deploy on short notice wherever needed. Altogether, the NRF comprises around 40,000 multinational troops.
The Pentagon press secretary, retired Rear Admiral John Kirby, in the Pentagon briefing room. A little bit later in his opening statement, he gave some more details about the U.S. troops who have been put on that heightened alert, ready to deploy.
The number of forces that the secretary has placed on heightened alert comes up to about 8,500 personnel. We'll continue to provide updates in coming days about these decisions, but specifically this will ensure that the United States and our commitment to the NRF is consistent with their readiness for rapid deployment, again, if activated. In the event of NATO's activation of the NRF or a deteriorating security environment, the United States would be in a position to rapidly deploy additional brigade combat teams, logistics, medical, aviation, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, transportation, and additional capabilities into Europe. Again, I want to reinforce that as of now, the decision has been made to put these units on higher alert and higher alert only. No decisions have been made to deploy any forces from the United States at this time. And when I say heightened alert, in some cases, some of these forces were already on a heightened posture, readiness to deploy posture, and the secretary decided to make it even more, shorten the tether even more. So in some cases, units would go from, say, 10 days prepared to deploy, now they're at 5 days. That's not the case for every unit that is being notified that they're on a heightened alert. Some are simply more ready and postured that way than others. The idea, though, is that all of these units that he is putting on prepare to deploy will be ready to go on a shortened time frame. Again, no final decision has been made to deploy them.
The Pentagon press secretary, John Kirby. You can find his full briefing, runs about 45 minutes, archived at our website, cspan.org. More from the Associated Press story, Russia has massed an estimated 100,000 troops near Ukraine's border, demanding that NATO promise it will never allow Ukraine to join, and that other actions, such as stationing alliance troops in former Soviet bloc countries, be curtailed. Some of these, like any pledge to permanently bar Ukraine, are non-starters for NATO, creating a seemingly intractable deadlock that many fear can only end in war. NATO early Monday putting out a statement saying it is putting forces on standby and reinforcing Eastern Europe with more ships and fighter jets. And during a joint news conference at NATO headquarters in Brussels with the visiting foreign ministers of Finland and Sweden, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg asked by a reporter for more details about this military buildup.
Yeah, Mr. Stoltenberg, as you said, NATO is sending reinforcements in Eastern Europe. Could you be a bit more precise? What is NATO's response to increased Russian military presence in the Baltic Sea?
So I have listed some of the additional deployments with more air policing, with more naval presence. Currently, there are five NATO ships in the Baltic Sea region, and we are also strengthening our presence in the air with the air policing. We already have deployed battle groups, NATO multinational battle groups, to the three Baltic countries and Poland. And we are, for the first time in a decade, we have a U.S. Aircraft carrier group under NATO command. That is not in the Baltic Sea, but of course it matters for the security of the whole of Europe. So we have stepped up, but this is defensive. NATO is not threatening Russia. It's proportionate. And at the same time as we step up, we also invite Russia to continue our dialogue, because we are ready to engage in good faith in the efforts to find a political solution. We are ready to listen to the Russian security concerns, also in the Baltic region, but we will not compromise on the right for every nation to choose its own path, and that also applies for Sweden, Finland, for other European nations, and not, of course, compromise on NATO's right to protect and defend all allies. But again, I think what we see now, with the increased tensions, the deteriorating security situation, just highlights the importance of the very close partnership we have built with Finland and Sweden over the last years, including in the Baltic region, with exercises, with a high degree of interoperability, and a very close political consultations that was also demonstrated today with a meeting with the two foreign ministers.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at a joint news conference at NATO headquarters in Brussels. In Moscow, a spokesman for the Kremlin, Dmitry Peskov, saying that NATO and the U.S. are behind the escalating tensions in Europe, not Russia. Peskov telling reporters, all this is happening not because of what we, Russia, are doing. This is happening because of what NATO, the U.S., are doing. Peskov also saying U.S. media reports suggesting that Russia is evacuating its diplomats from Ukraine are not true. U.S. on Sunday did order families of U.S. diplomats to leave Kyiv, the capital city of Ukraine, but made departures of U.S. government officials voluntary and urged U.S. citizens there to leave. More on all of that today at the State Department briefing with spokesman Ned Price.
The partial evacuation of the embassy clearly shows you're concerned about the safety of Americans in Ukraine. You've also made it very clear what would happen if Russia were to invade. Will you take this opportunity now also to warn Russia against harming any Americans and say what the consequence would be if they did?
So let me take that question and make clear that we have no higher priority than the safety and security of Americans around the world. And last night, you heard us speak to the prudent steps we are taking in the context of our diplomatic community in Kyiv, knowing that the Russians have this large military buildup, that they could well be poised to take significant aggressive action at any moment. And so the authorized departure of non-emergency employees of our embassy and the ordered departure of dependents is part and parcel of and reflective of the paramount priority we attach to the safety and security of the American people. I don't want to go into private discussions, but we have made it abundantly clear to the Russians the priority we attach to the safety and security of the American people. They know that that is our highest priority. They know that we go to extraordinary lengths to protect their safety and security, and I'll leave it at that.
In terms of the numbers of people, of Americans inside Ukraine, yesterday I know that State Department wouldn't be drawn on exact numbers, but is that because you don't know how many, or you just won't say how many Americans are inside Ukraine?
Our goal always is to provide you with timely and accurate information. And right now, we do not have an account that we consider to be accurate of the number of Americans, private Americans, who are resident in Ukraine. And I'll tell you why. You've heard this in the context of Afghanistan, but when Americans travel overseas, they, of course, are not required to register with the embassy in country. We always encourage Americans to register when they're traveling abroad with our so-called STEP system. But I think as many of you can attest, when you travel overseas, you may not always do that. And some of you probably have never done that. Similarly, when Americans depart the country, they would need to deregister themselves. And so given that many may not register in the first place, I think it is a safe assumption that many would, those who actually do register, may not remove themselves from that tally of American citizens who may be resident in a foreign country. The other point is that even when people do register, the State Department is not in a position to independently verify that a person who has signed up in STEP, the so-called STEP system, is actually an American citizen. So there are a number of reasons. We just don't have an accurate tally at the moment. When we have messaged with the American people in private American citizen community in Kyiv, in Ukraine, in recent days, we have encouraged them to fill out a form that will help us acquire greater granularity on the size of the American private American citizen community in Ukraine. But that's just not something that we have right now.
State Department spokesman Ned Price with reporters in the State Department briefing room. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his Russian counterpart, the Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, on Friday. And Blinken saying that he expects to have a written response to Russia's demands this week. Ned Price confirming today that is expected this week. The U.S. will provide a written response. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield saying current tensions with Russia are bigger than Ukraine. She says Russia's actions are undermining the collective principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter that are agreed upon by all nations to maintain global peace and security. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield held a news conference at the Foreign Press Center in New York City.
There is only one country with 100,000 troops pre-positioned on the border, participating in war games and spreading propaganda, and that's Russia. We have consistently pushed back against Russia's fictitious narratives, and we will continue to do so. And it is imperative that the world sees Russia's actions rather than just listening to its words. It is also crucial that other UN member states understand how Russia's aggression undermines their own peace and security. Today, Russia is threatening Ukraine and its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But this is also bigger than Ukraine. Russia's actions undermine the foundational principles enshrined in the UN Charter. These are principles to which we have collectively and freely agreed in order to maintain global peace and security. Specifically, UN member states have all agreed that one nation cannot simply change the borders of another by force, nor can one nation dictate to another its choices, its alliances, its partnerships under threat of violence. If Russia further invades Ukraine, it would strike at the very heart of the UN Charter. And it would, to use Secretary Blinken's phrase last week, open up a Pandora's box of concerns for all of us. Russia's actions toward Ukraine are not only a regional issue. They impact every UN member state. And we must be prepared to stand together in unity and solidarity should Russia defy the shared values and principles that undergird our international system.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, at the New York Foreign Press Center. BBC News in Great Britain writing that the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned Russia that invading Ukraine would be disastrous and a painful, violent, and bloody business. Speaking as the Foreign Office pulled some embassy staff out of Ukraine, the Prime Minister said the situation was pretty gloomy, but war was not inevitable. He said the United Kingdom was leading on creating a package of economic sanctions against Russia and was supplying defensive weaponry to Ukraine. Here's part of his comments to the press.
Look, I've got to tell you that I think that the intelligence is pretty gloomy on this point. There is certainly a large, very, very large array of Russian forces and we have to take the necessary steps. I don't think it's by any means inevitable now. I think that sense can still prevail, but the UK is in the lead in creating that package of economic sanctions, stiffening the helping to stiffen the resistance of our Ukrainian friends, as you know, with defensive weaponry that we're supplying, making it clear that we stand fully four square with the people of Ukraine, and that we support the sovereign integrity of Ukraine, and we do. But we also need to get over to Russia, that any invasion, any incursion of any kind, of any dimension into Ukraine is not going to be a cost-free business. It is not going to be there will be casualties. And I think that people in Russia need to understand that it could be their new Chechnya. The intelligence is very clear that there are 60 Russian battle groups, about 60 Russian battle groups on the borders of Ukraine. The plan for a lightning war that could take out Kiev is one that everybody can see. We need to make it very clear to the Kremlin, to Russia, that would be a disastrous step. And so what we're saying is that the UK is leading on creating the package of economic sanctions, working with our partners around the world. I'll be talking to them this afternoon, this evening, talking to colleagues in other capitals and in Washington. But we also need to get over the message that invading Ukraine from a Russian perspective is going to be a painful, violent, and bloody business. And I think it's very important that people in Russia understand that this could be a new Chechnya. I've been to Ukraine several times. I know the people of that country a bit. And my judgment is that they will fight. And really, that is not the way the world should be going. And I hope that they understand that in the Kremlin. But it's the job of the UK to make sure that our friends and partners around the world, particularly in Europe, you mentioned Europe, also understand that, and we get ready a tough enough package of sanctions.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking with reporters during a visit to a hospital in Milton Keynes, England. He was there mainly to talk about COVID-19, but getting some questions about Russia and Ukraine. This weekend, a British government office saying it has information indicating the Russian government plans to install a pro-Russian leader in power in Kyiv, Russia saying that report is false. Thomas Pickering is a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. He was there during the 1990s. He's a retired career diplomat who served in many other posts over the years, starting with President Nixon, running through President Clinton. Today, he gave his assessment of the situation between Russia and the Western nations, with Ukraine caught in the middle.
Much of what he has propounded, either in red lines or charges against the U.S. and the West, is something which can appeal to the nationalism that has always been present in Russia, never far from the surface, and puts him at the center, if you like, of public attention and public popularity. And while he goes up and down in public popularity, a certain amount of this activity on his part is orchestrated, I think, at critical times for him to reinforce it. I also think it's very important to point out that a good bit of what we are seeing has the character of being made up. It is not something that we see naturally occurring on the scene. I don't dispute George Kennan, and some will know that recently there was the release in public of a telegram that we wrote from the embassy back at the beginning days of NATO enlargement, in which we did repeat the arguments that George Kennan had made, and we updated them and felt very strongly that this would, for then President Yeltsin, produce a challenge that would not be easily undertaken on the Russian side and be seen as expansionist from their perspective and imposing. But other things that we have seen, including this enormous buildup that's gone on, moving 125,000 soldiers is not a trivial activity, including with large amounts of equipment, which we've seen on the photography that brings it home. And so it is a very worrying situation given those elements. And I leave those on the table for all of you to look at. It is very difficult to predict Mr. Putin. And it's no easier, I think, with the kind of dissection and analysis we have just been through with you here, where it may be a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a certain amount of staying alive. But it gives him the flexibility that he's exploited to try to maintain himself out ahead of the wave of change going on in the confrontation that exists between both sides, change not to the good side.
Thomas Pickering, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, today talking about the Russian President Vladimir Putin, a discussion hosted by the Center for the National Interest. ABC News has this: as tensions rise in the standoff over Ukraine, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has warned the U.S. response to a possible Russian invasion could result in a cyber attack launched against the U.S. by the Russian government or its proxies. And from the South China Morning Post, China on Monday dismissed a report suggesting President Xi Jinping may have asked his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, not to invade Ukraine during the Beijing Winter Olympic Games. Report by Bloomberg, quoting an anonymous diplomat, said it was possible Xi had asked Putin during their recent call not to invade Ukraine during the Beijing Games. Winter Olympics in China begin on February 4th. There's also a focus on that country because of human rights concerns. President Biden announcing a diplomatic boycott over that issue. No official U.S. delegation will be attending. Several other countries following suit, including Great Britain, Japan, and Australia. Today on Capitol Hill, U.S. Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, says that more should be said about this.
It is a fact that the Communist Chinese Party is committing horrific human rights abuses against Tibetans, Hong Kongers, and Uyghur Muslims. It is a fact that at the direction of General Secretary Xi, the Communist Chinese Party is committing genocide and desecrating the Uyghur homeland. It is a fact that Beijing continues to systematically destroy democracy in Hong Kong. I saw it with my own eyes when I visited there in 2019. Next week, the 2022 Olympics will begin in Beijing, and the world will watch as Communist China, it's Communist China, let's never forget that, whitewashes these crimes and churns its propaganda machine to make the world forget just how evil this empire is. I can't tell you how worried I am about the athletes competing in Beijing. Look at what Communist China did to silence and disappear. Silence and disappear, Peng Shuai. It's terrifying. I've called on the IOC and the Biden administration to take every step necessary to keep Americans safe. But unfortunately, I haven't heard a word from them on what they're doing about it. We cannot let anyone forget about what is happening in Communist China. NBC must use the Olympics to highlight these atrocities. Sadly, I doubt they will. That's why we're here today, to make sure no one forgets. For years, I've been calling for the Olympics not for a boycott, but be moved out of Communist China. For years, I've been highlighting Communist China's brutal abuses and demanding accountability for Communist China's genocide and attacks on democracy. For years, I've been demanding businesses to stop doing business with Communist China.
Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida on Capitol Hill with a number of human rights advocates. A Reuters story from last week reads, athletes traveling to next month's Beijing Olympics were warned about speaking up on human rights issues while in China for their own safety by speakers at a seminar hosted by Human Rights Watch. Washington Today continues in a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to, as the New York Times writes it, decide whether race-conscious admissions programs at Harvard and the University of North Carolina are lawful, putting the fate of affirmative action in higher education at risk. The court has repeatedly upheld similar programs, most recently in 2016, but recent changes in the court's membership have made it more conservative, and the challenged programs are almost certain to meet skepticism. Case against Harvard accused it of discriminating against Asian American students by using a subjective standard to gauge traits like likability, courage, and kindness, and by effectively creating a ceiling for them in admissions. That was from the New York Times. Of course, when that case goes before the Supreme Court, we'll have coverage on C-SPAN. And a judge in Fulton County, Georgia, approving a special grand jury to aid the district attorney's investigation into former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the state's 2020 election results. Reporting in the New York Post, Mayor Eric Adams on Monday unveiled plans to crack down on illegal guns like the one used to kill a rookie New York Police Department officer and critically injure another cop in Harlem last week while displaying photos of the illegal murder weapons. Adams said the NYPD would start by focusing on the 30 police precincts where 80% of the city's violence takes place. Mayor Adams speaking from City Hall about what he calls a blueprint for safety.
There are no gun manufacturers in New York City. Yet even as the NYPD removed 6,000 guns from our streets last year, we know that new guns are arriving by car, by bus, and by train every day. The NYPD will work with state law enforcement to implement spot checks at every entry point like Port Authority and other bus and train stations. We will also move forward on using the latest in technology to identify problems, follow up on leads, and collect evidence. From facial recognition technology to new tools that can spot those carrying weapons, we will use every available method to keep our people safe. We will also expand the Gun Violence Suppression Division. This highly specialized unit within the Detective Bureau is tasked with seizing illegal guns and building cases against gun sellers and weapons traffickers. And we will continue the Gun Violence Strategic Partnership, a daily meeting that brings together local, state, and federal leaders to share intelligence and information on specific cases. And finally, my administration will increase coordination and information sharing with the ATF, FBI, and all federal partners. Gun violence is not only a law enforcement issue. It is a social issue, a community issue. We will be taking a citywide approach to meeting this challenge. New Yorkers have heard me say many times that any effective plan to reduce gun violence must include intervention and prevention. We must take action to immediately stop the violence, and we must make long-term investments to keep it from returning. We must address the root causes of these challenges and help our young people on a better path long before they pick up a gun.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams, a Democrat, giving a speech today at City Hall in New York City. And after that speech, he went and took reporters' questions. One was about the role of New York State and the U.S. federal government in helping stop the flow of guns into that city.
Can you describe a scenario where for every gun the police department gets off the street, there are another five that make their way back into the city? How much confidence do you have in this plan stopping Niagara Falls? Can you tell the public, can you tell your cops that this is going to be what turns the 2-year tsunami of gun violence?
Right, and you know what, Nolan, I wish I could. I wish I could. What I am going to tell to my cops and to the city of New York, we are going to do our job. My agencies are going to do their job and stop feeding crisis. My police department, they're doing their job. These police officers are saying, we need help. That's what they're saying. They're saying we need help to stop the flow. We need help to stop putting people back on the street that are dangerous. They're saying we need help. I mean, what we have done to these police officers in this city, where we, from pouring water on their heads to not giving them the authority to do the job, saying we're not going to prosecute fare evasions, allowing people to walk into stores and take whatever they want off the shelves, and then we point to the police officers and say, keep us safe. They're saying we need help. And so what I'm saying to them, I don't have the authority to tell Washington what to do. I don't have the authority to tell the state what to do. I'm going to plead with them and speak with them. But I'm telling them in this city, they're going to get the help from their mayor.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams on the job just a couple of weeks. The murder rate in 2021 in the U.S. was the highest in 25 years, and a number of major American cities did set new records. Now to COVID-19, Dr. Anthony Fauci on the White House COVID-19 response team predicting that the U.S. will, in the next couple of weeks, reach the peak in Omicron cases nationwide. He was interviewed today on MSNBC.
Well, it certainly reached this peak in certain regions of the country. If you look at the Northeast, you know, epitomized by New York City, Chicago, and then the upper Middle West with Chicago, it certainly has reached the point where it's turning around and cases are coming down. However, in some of the southern states and the western states, it has not yet peaked, and it's either continuing to go up or leveling off, which is the first step towards getting to that peak and turning around. I believe that in the next few weeks, we will see as a country that it is all turning around. Right now, the net effect, if you look at it, even though, as you mentioned, we still have close to 700,000 cases a day, and we have about 150,000 people in the hospital and about 2,000 deaths. In general, it is starting to turn around, and I believe you're going to see that going in that direction over the next couple of weeks.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on MSNBC today. Washington Post writes, new coronavirus cases have fallen 14% in the United States in the past week based on a seven-day average, although average daily cases at more than 695,000 are still not far from the U.S. peak of about 762,000. COVID-19 hospitalizations are also close to their peak, straining short-staffed hospitals, but they're also starting to fall. COVID-19 deaths, which often lag days to weeks behind outbreaks, are still increasing nationally. Another COVID prediction today, this from the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He said that more virus variants are likely.
There are different scenarios for how the pandemic could play out and how the acute phase could end. But it's dangerous to assume that Omicron will be the last variant or that we are in the end game. On the contrary, globally, the conditions are ideal for more variants to emerge. To change the course of the pandemic, we must change the conditions that are driving it. If countries use all of these strategies and tools in a comprehensive way, we can end the acute phase of the pandemic this year. We can end COVID-19 as a global health emergency, and we can do it this year. What does that look like? It means achieving our target to vaccinate 70% of the population of every country with a focus on the most at-risk groups.
WHO Director Dr. Tedros, news conference at the World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva. He says since the Omicron variant was identified 9 weeks ago, there have been more than 80 million COVID cases reported to WHO worldwide, and that's more than were reported in the whole of 2020. And someone has lost their life to the virus every 12 seconds. Another story at the Washington Post reads thousands of protesters from across the country, including some of the biggest names in the anti-vaccination movement, descended on the nation's capital Sunday for a rally against vaccine mandates. Almost 2 years into a coronavirus pandemic that has killed more than 860,000 Americans, the gathering on the National Mall was a jarring spectacle. A crowd of demonstrators, many unmasked, decrying vaccine mandates in the middle of a city that has adopted mask and vaccine mandates to reduce sickness and death from the surge of the virus's Omicron variant, which has battered D.C. for weeks. That was the reporting from the Washington Post. One of the speakers at that rally in Washington on Sunday, we covered it on C-SPAN, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
What we're seeing today is what I call turnkey totalitarianism. They are putting in place all of these technological mechanisms for control we've never seen before. It's been the ambition of every totalitarian state from the beginning of mankind to control every aspect of behavior, of conduct, of thought, and to obliterate dissent. None of them have been able to do it. They didn't have the technological capacity. Even in Hitler Germany, you could cross the Alps into Switzerland. You can hide in an attic like Anne Frank did. I visited in 1962 East Germany with my father and met people who had climbed the wall and escaped. So it was possible. Many died doing it, but it was possible. Today, the mechanisms are being put in place that will make it so none of us can run and none of us can hide. Within 5 years, we're going to see 415,000 low-orbit satellites. Bill Gates says his 65,000 satellites alone will be able to look at every square inch of the planet 24 hours a day. They're putting in 5G to harvest our data and control our behavior. Digital currency that will allow them to punish us from a distance and cut off our food supply. Vaccine passports. You have a series of rights, as flawed as our government is. You can still go out and go to a bar. You can go to a sporting event. You can get on a bus or an airplane, and you can travel. You have certain freedoms. You can get educated, etc. The minute they hand you that vaccine passport, every right that you have is transformed into a privilege contingent upon your obedience to arbitrary government dictates.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., founder and chair of Children's Health Defense Anti-Vaccine Advocacy Group, at an anti-vaccine mandate rally at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. He is the son of the late presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy and nephew to the late president John F. Kennedy. Auschwitz Memorial, the organization that remembers the more than 1 million killed at that Nazi concentration camp, their Twitter feed tweeting, "Exploiting of the tragedy of people who suffered, were humiliated, tortured, and murdered by the totalitarian regime of Nazi Germany, including children like Anne Frank, in a debate about vaccines and limitations during global pandemic is a sad symptom of moral and intellectual decay." Wall Street Today, the Dow up 99, but it was down at one point more than 1,000. NASDAQ finishing up 86, S&P up 12. President Biden talking about the economy and inflation at the White House. He made some opening statements, and as the press was asked to be escorted out, Peter Doocy of Fox News asked the president a question, and the president was caught on a hot mic.
Do you think inflation is a political liability?
That's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a bitch.
President Biden at the White House. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories sent right to you by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. Hope you have a good night.